Welcome to Analyst Talk with Jason Elder. It's like coffee with an analyst, or it could be whiskey with an analyst reading a spreadsheet, linking crime events, identifying a series, and getting the latest scoop on association news and training. So please don't beat that analyst and join us as we define the law enforcement analysis profession one episode at a time.
Thank you for joining me. I hope many aspects of your life are progressing. My name is Jason Elder, and today our guest has 27 years of law enforcement analysis experience. She spent time with the Ohio Attorney General's Office in the Bureau of Criminal Investigation, and now is the Executive Director of the Ohio Narcotics Intelligence Center. She's a certified analyst with IALEA, and we're going to talk about her journey from analyst, supervisor, to director. Representing the great state of Ohio, please welcome Cynthia Peterman. Cindy, how are we doing?
Hi, Jason. Thank you.
So yeah, well, now that you mentioned that, are you an Ohio State fan?
Oh, of course. Yeah. Fifth generation. Yeah.
Fifth generation. Fantastic. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So big football fan then?
Of course.
All right. So now that Hallborough's gone, you feeling good?
Oh, I hope we get things back on track this year. That's for sure.
Oh, it's all changing. There's so much money. I don't know. It's basically like a professional sports league. There's so much going on with college football. But we better watch ourselves because I could talk a half hour about college football. So, but anyway, let's get back on track here. How did you discover the law enforcement analysis profession?
I didn't come from a law enforcement family. No one in my family was in law enforcement. We do have a rich military history, but no one was law enforcement. So I discovered it in a very roundabout way. I was in the Lieutenant Governor's office when they helped facilitate the funding for the first APHIS grant in Ohio. So yes, I'm a dinosaur. I predate APHIS, but that's how I learned about the Ohio BCI criminal repository in London and all things BCI. Got to know the superintendent through the facilitation of that grant money and development of the APHIS. And my boss, the lieutenant governor at the time, won election to the United States Senate. So he left to the Senate. I jumped over to the governor's office. He won a seat in the United States Senate. And so the superintendent of BCI followed me along in those hops and said, I know your boss is leaving for the Senate. I'd love for you to come out to BCI and learn more about what we do and how you might be able to fit into some of an opening out at BCI. And I thought, okay, so went out for what I thought was going to be a conversation. It turned out to be much like a Men in Black sort of interview. It was 2.5 hours long of every question under the sun, personally, professionally, including who had recently won the World Series. Why is there fuzz on a tennis ball? Just everything. I remember going home that night and thinking, I don't know what happened. Like, I don't know what just happened. I'm okay. I will figure it out. But a few days later, they surprised me and called and said, when can you start? And I thought, really?
Your mind might have got wiped there after the interview, right?
It was certainly interesting. But I started there doing some grant writing and quickly just acclimated into the intelligence field. There, they had an intelligence unit and a couple of researchers that were in the unit. And I think a combination of grants and tech savvy and being a Access and Excel whiz back in the day, found myself in the intelligence unit helping work cases. And we changed our titles from researchers to criminal intelligence analysts and really helped sort of set the foundation for the intelligence unit moving forward there at BCI. So that's how I came into it in a very roundabout way.
Yeah. So just a couple of follow-up questions. So APHIS, that's fingerprinting, right?
Yep.
And London, that's London, Ohio, not over the pond, right?
Correct. Yeah.
Okay.
The state headquarters for Ohio BCI is in London, Ohio.
Okay. All right. So then when you get through the MIB interview, which I find fascinating that you just came in for a conversation and then they're asking you all these wild questions and you didn't even, did you even know it was an interview or did they just said, hey, can you come in for a meeting?
Well, I mean, it was, I thought it was more of an informal conversation, but yeah. I think very quickly they saw something and it very quickly morphed into an interview. And I think really the sports stuff just came naturally in the conversation, but it was definitely interesting.
Yeah. So you start there. This is 1997. And so, and as you mentioned, you did eventually change the titles there to criminal intelligence analyst. So what did this position morph into? What were you all focused on in terms of the Bureau of Criminal Identification at this time?
Yeah. In that criminal intelligence unit, we had three analysts. One focused on narcotics cases, one focused on major crime, and I was focused on the white collar crime. And so we were supporting those criminal investigations across the state.
Yeah. Okay. And then you got nicknamed the white collar crime girl.
Yep. The white collar crime girl at BCI. Yep.
All right. So let's just talk a little about some of those cases and just roughly there. So what kind of things did you get into?
Oh my gosh, everything under the sun. I mean, we helped support cases that had public official corruption, illegal gambling rings, thefts and frauds, and all kinds of things at BCI. Now, yeah,
in those early days. Is the jurisdiction statewide?
They do, and they have sort of like very limited original jurisdiction. So mostly in the intelligence unit, it's a request by request basis. So there's no requirement for any local law enforcement to use those analysts or those services at BCI on the investigative side. But Ohio has about 1,000 law enforcement agencies, and the majority of them, like more than 70%, are 25 personnel or less. So when you think about what those agencies might look like personnel-wise, resource-wise, funding, BCI was a service that they could tap into when cases went beyond what either their expertise was or what tools they might have and those kinds of things. So those were the kind of cases that we would get in the criminal intelligence unit there at CI.
All right. But so you might be helping out smaller jurisdictions, but that doesn't mean that the data itself is small, right? This is a lot of detail that you're going through at this time.
Right. We covered everything from environmental dumping to unidentified decedents in that little unit. Yeah. And it grew over time. We added a few analysts as we went. And then when I became supervisor, I talked them into letting me expand the intelligence unit out into the field. They have regional offices across the state, but they didn't have intelligence analysts out in those regional offices. And so we were trying to support all of the investigations statewide from the London office, which is kind of central west of Ohio. And that could be
like Columbus, like just outside
of
Columbus.
Yeah, just west of Columbus. Yeah. But that going from there to Youngstown or Ashtabula or Jackson County was a haul. We were spending all day on the road to go support a case for a couple hours and then bring information back. So we laid out a plan and implemented intelligence analysts out in those regional offices. So I'm extremely proud of that. I think when I left BCI, I think we had 17 analysts out in the field. So yeah, extremely proud of all of what we did and what they are doing, what they continue to do today.
All right. So yeah, a lot of growth. So you get into, and you did that as a supervisor. Is that's what you said?
Yep. Supervisor and deputy director level. Yep.
All right. So then growth to the supervisor. I mean, did that come naturally or was there an interview for the supervisor? What was that like? Is that like MIB 2.0 or what?
That was totally normal interview. Yeah. So yeah, I went from being an analyst to supervising my peers, which is always challenging. But I was just super blessed to have amazing people and personalities who just continued to thrive and shine. And so we really established ourselves across the state as a premier intelligence agency. capable of providing support on of any level case. And so that was a lot of fun, a lot of growth, a lot of fun building that team up. We also were tasked with the missing persons responsibilities in the state. After those three ladies were found in that house in Cleveland, they reorged some of those responsibilities and housed the missing persons unit within the criminal intelligence unit at BCI. So again, more responsibility, more growth, more challenges. I think it's just a testament to the really and the good products that were coming out of that unit that we just continued to be entrusted with additional responsibilities as we went on.
Yeah. Those three ladies that you mentioned, is that the one where the person that found them, did that have something to do with fast food? Is that the one, or is that something totally different? Is my memory?
Oh, no. One of the ladies managed to escape. And but
all right. Think of a total different case then. Okay.
Yeah, I can't recall a fast food element to that one. Maybe.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking that the guy that was the hero of the case, like, they said, he said, all I really wanted was McDonald's. And then it became this big thing that, like, McDonald's
might have been
something like that. I can't, and it might not even have been McDonald's. That's how bad, like, I'm probably butchering that story. So we'll just disregard that and move on. All right. You go in then, and now you become deputy director. And so that's a whole other level of leadership, though. Like, so you go from managing, supervising analysts, then when you become deputy director, how many folks are you responsible for?
Yeah, we took on the missing persons unit and then also the Ohio Law Enforcement Gateway, which is a law enforcement portal in Ohio with Ohio law enforcement criminal information in it. And so there were obviously a 24-hour staff that went along with that responsibility, but also, gosh, I think we had like 40,000 users across the state, and managing all of those users and agencies that were coming on board, and all of the portal resources that were available through there. So a lot of IT heavy meetings. Yeah, definitely kept the responsibilities kept coming.
Yeah. Well, it's, as I see the path there, you're the analyst, right? And dealing with cases and working with the units there. And then you go on to be a supervisor, and you're supervising analysts there. And when you're a supervisor, there's some things administratively, you're making sure that certain things get done. But once you get to deputy director, I mean, that seems to me that's more into planning. That seems like a lot of meetings. That's a lot of coordination. It's getting away from the typical analyst work.
Definitely. Like I said earlier, just super blessed to have an amazing intelligence team that just continued to knock it out of the park, even though my attention had been expanded to other tasks and other issues. But yeah, it just continued to morph for me.
All right. Well, let's tell some stories now. It brings us to your analyst badge story. And for those that may be new to the show, the analyst badge story is the career-defining case or project that an analyst works. And so we've got a couple for us today. Let's start with early 2000s. So this is when you're still an analyst, and you are, well, I'll just let you tell the story.
Yeah, so I worked with crime scene agents a lot, and we produced court-ready products for them to take to court. And one of the pivotal cases for me was a case of a very young little girl who was raped and thrown down a well and passed away. Lucky enough to find her and to find her justice. We got a conviction. All of the things went right from there. But conviction, victory, right? And things are going well. We've moved on to the next cases. And I don't know, it was some weeks later that my mom and I had been out shopping, and we rolled into my driveway, and my daughter, who was about 3 or 4 at the time, came running out to greet us. Grandma's here, right? And I see her come across the sidewalk, and I just immediately burst into tears. I mean, there was no thought about it. It just was this rush of emotion. And my mom says, are you okay? And I said, I think I just need a moment. can you go take care of Taylor? And I just need to sit for a moment. I'm not sure what really just happened here. And so I collected myself and I went in the next business day. I went in to see, again, just amazingly blessed to have a victims advocate on staff at BCI. Her name is Cindy too. So if you're listening, much love. I went into her office and I said, I just need somebody to talk to. And I know that's what you do for a living. So please just hear me out. And I kind of explained what happened. And I said, Taylor, little blonde 3 or 4 year old, had the exact same shirt. It was back in the day, it was Rugrats were popular. She had the exact same Rugrats t-shirt as the little girl down in the well had. And she was also a little blonde girl. And so I had this, I don't know, a synapse snapped. I don't know what happened. Just this moment where all of the emotions just rushed. And so I explained this to Cindy and she very calmly and patiently listened. And the first thing that she said, that which made me feel instantly better, was, you're not the first person who worked on this case to come talk to me about it. It was obviously very trying for all of you on that particular case. And then she started to talk to me about vicarious trauma and what that means. And now I think we're so much more conscious of mental health and well-being and things like that, that vicarious trauma is almost part of the onboarding anymore of you're in law enforcement. You're going to be exposed to some things and they are horrible. And it's okay if you're not okay with these things sometimes. Here's some healthy tools to deal with it. But back then we these were new words to me anyway. And I don't want to say that I'm glad that I had a moment, but I'm glad because it expanded my mind to understand those things and to digest them, not only for myself, but I took those ideas and concepts with Cindy back into the unit. And we started doing annual vicarious trauma training with the staff, because I thought, if I'm having a reaction to this kind of case, my coworkers probably are too. And it was pretty well received. And I think that they still continue to do those trainings in their staff. And I definitely carry those well-being and vicarious trauma trainings to my staff today as well. So just something that was a negative thing for me turned into a really good lesson, not only for myself, but for me to be able to help onboard my staff even to this day to just be aware that the things that we're dealing with are not we see the worst, and it's okay to be upset by them sometimes, and then to have healthy tools and safety nets in place for people that have occasionally hit their limit with it. So yeah, that was definitely a very pivotal case for me and a great one as a manager. And I think it helps too for me as a manager to talk about that case with my staff, to let them know that it's a safe place. It's okay to be a little bit vulnerable at times, and you're gonna have a safe place to do that, and we're gonna have safety nets for you if you have those kinds of emotional reactions.
Yeah, I think it's, as analysts, first I'll say this. Kudos to your unit. I do think you were ahead of your time there. Certainly hear a lot more about wellness these days. Last 5 years, we've talked about it a little bit on this show. I've been to conferences when they've been talking about it recently. So it's definitely something that you're hearing more and more about, which is good. And I think for analysts, you can go in your career a long time with just looking at data. And when I say that data in that respect, it's just maybe on a computer screen, and maybe once in a while you can read a case. And if the detective wrote a certain amount in the narrative, you get a clearer picture of what it is. But you get to that point where if you start seeing photos or video and you actually see what went on. I mean, I remember that. There was a case when I was at Baltimore Police Department where there was it was like a child abuse case where there was photos, and we were going through, and there was just, you could just see the physical trauma that was put on that child. So it was just a way different perspective than if I just read the synopsis of the case. Mm-hmm. So I can imagine for you then, as you're going through this and you actually see the maybe the photos or whatever you had seen with the little girl in the shirt, that that's a whole different ball game there of what you experienced.
Yeah, I think it helped me build a safe place for analysts to share their emotions and share how they're feeling about things. And then that allows me as a manager to make sure that the right trainings are in place and the right tools are in place for them to be able to handle things. So yeah, you're absolutely correct.
Right. And then your other story deals with a missing person. It's around 2011 here, and just let's get into that, because I think there's a theme here, and I think it's important that you have these cases, and then how do you take it and build a team in the future?
Yeah. I'm old, and I've been doing this for 31 years now, and I've made an awful lot of mistakes, and I'm very open about mistakes that I have made, so that please learn from me. But yeah, so we had a missing persons case back there at BCI, and it was one that we had a missing persons case, and then we had a unidentified decedent, and we were able to make that match between the unidentified decedent and the missing persons case. And when we do those, to this day, when they do those, it is an amazing feeling, right? Because some of those cases can be out there for literally decades. And that unit does such an amazing job of trying every single thing that they can to bring attention to the cases, to, you know, bring resources to every single case. And so we were really, really excited about this one. She had been missing for quite a while. The unidentified decedent, that took a while to get the DNA match. When we did, it was celebratory. We're putting a name to an unidentified decedent. We were bringing closure for a family on a missing persons case. And we had prepped with our communications people about all of the good things that happened, right? And so a media outlet comes and wants to do a little story about it. And we're ready. We're prepped. And they put the lights, camera, action, got a camera and a microphone in my face. And this reporter just starts saying horrible things about our victim. Why would you spend taxpayer money on a streetwalker? This was just a prostitute. Why would you take this case? Just a litany of negative things about our victim. And I was absolutely stunned, just stunned. I'm sure there was a long silence while I'm going, wait, what just happened? And she kept kind of poking me, and I finally just get my head together, like, you know, camera's rolling, can't say what I really want to say right now. So I got to find my words, right? So I find my words, and I say what I want to say about just what I said earlier, pouring every resource into every case and doing everything that we can to bring closure for the families. I said everything just exactly the way I wanted to, but I just did not see that negative spin coming. I did not foresee, and our media people did not foresee that coming either. Like, it felt like an attack of, why are you wasting resources on this streetwalker? I mean, these were words she used, not me. And it was just absolutely stunning to me. So I didn't see it coming. But when I was talking about doing this podcast, my current staff, I had told that story. And we actually use it again for training development. All our managers and onboarding folks go through a media class where we give them little scenarios, and we put cameras, bright cameras and microphones in their face, and we ask really tough questions. So again, it's a lesson from here was my mistake. I didn't see it coming, but I can use that negative experience to help develop training for my folks from here and on into the future. So yeah, again, learn from the goofy things that I have done. Yeah.
Now, in terms of the case itself, was it a long drawn out case that it would have taken a lot of resources to solve?
It was a pretty big case. That gentleman had multiple decedents that he was responsible for. So it did take quite a bit of resources to sort of unravel all of the things that were going on there, and then to help make those connections with our missing persons cases. It's the work of the boots on the ground at the crime scene and getting everything to forensics, getting those cases run, getting the matches made, and then making those secondary identifications, making sure with that what we're getting ready to say is factual. So there is quite a bit to every single one of those cases on both sides. In the missing persons case too, you try to do everything you can to realize if they are voluntary missing, if they walked away from their life for one reason or another, or if something nefarious has happened to them. So there's quite a bit of work that goes into both sides of those cases. But the reporter just taking that angle of why did you spend resources on it was just not something that I saw coming at all. And so,
Now, did it play out when they did publish the interview? Did it play out as bad as it felt when it was going on?
It felt terrible. And I was mortified. Imagine. Yeah. Here I am thinking it's going to be my last day. And actually, when the story aired up in that region, some of my colleagues said it actually sounded absolutely perfect. So, I mean, the reporter did a great job, I guess. And once I got myself together, I did just fine. But I like to use those stories with my staff to help guide them and help develop them so that they're prepared. They're more prepared for those sort of moments that you don't always anticipate.
No, I really like the training. It's beyond, I think, what a lot of agencies do. I mean, I think for the most part, most agencies would say, hey, just tell them you're not the spokesman. You can just, or spokesperson, I should say, and you don't talk to them, or there might be just something that there. It wouldn't be this training where like, okay, we're going to actually sit you down and we're going to go through an actual scenario there to teach you how to do it.
Yep.
So kudos. Yep. Kudos to you again and your team.
Thanks.
Hey, this is Steve Belts, and I've got a pet peeve I want to share with you folks. You know, we all have the cell phone driving issue, but I kind of take it down more to the local level here. It's not dangerous, but extremely annoying. I'm having to make my way through airports now again, and you get that person in front of you that's either reading something off their cell phone or talking to somebody on their cell phone, and you're trying to get to your gate, and you don't realize that people are backing up behind them, just like as if they were driving a car. Get off your cell phones and or pull over to the curb with your cell phone in the airport and get it out of the way. So appreciate it. Thanks.
Hi, this is Adrienne Galbrick. Have you ever received an email on a giant listserv and started to hit reply all instead of just reply? If so, you're not the only one, and just always pause and double check before you hit send.
All right, so then let's talk about then you moving on to the Ohio Narcotics Intelligence Center. So what went into that decision?
The Attorney General at the time, Mike DeWine, we had worked really, really closely with him, the intelligence unit on the Pike County homicides. And we were working with him or his staff, I think, just about on a daily basis as those cases developed. And really, he really got to know the intelligence capabilities and that force multiplier that intel can be in investigations. And so when he was running for governor, he had laid out what he called the Recovery Ohio Plan, because at that point, overdoses were just off the charts. And he felt like the state needed to prioritize plans and programming and investigative resources around the overdose epidemic. And he basically said to me, I want you to this intelligence support team that you've got here at BCI, I want you to come with us over to the Department of Public Safety, and we're going to start a team over there that is focused on the illicit drug supply in the state of Ohio. And so it was a really easy sell for me. It was, he was prioritizing data. I mean, his plan, like number one was to declare a state of emergency with regard to the overdose epidemic. And he did that. And then points number two and three were all around data and intelligence and investigative support and working to help de-silo data in the state of Ohio. And then address the investigative pieces of the illicit narcotics field of cartels bringing drugs in and the changing landscape of the illicit market and what is precipitating the overdoses. And he really got me. I mean, it was an analyst's dream, right? To have that kind of job laid out in front of them. It was not a tough sell. It was exciting to be in a position to start a unit up with from nothing. I mean, I say nothing, but we had the most amazing support. We had amazing support all the way, starting with the governor, which a lot of agencies don't get that kind of support and funding. And we started with a really modest idea of we were going to hire 3 or 4 intel analysts and a forensic specialist or two. And we were going to work with a couple of drug task forces to kind of see what the need was. And so we pitched to Governor DeWine on his fourth day of office this really modest plan. And he thought about it for a while. It was an uncomfortable silence where, again, I'm thinking, oh, I've done it this time. And surely this is my last day. And he kind of like sort of slammed his fist and said, I love it, but I want bigger. You're gonna have 10 analysts and you're going to have an office in Columbus and Cleveland, and you're going to have more forensic specialists than that. And you're going to really dig in and get out there into those agencies and see what we can do to help bolster their cases. And I walked out saying, well, that escalated quickly. And so that's where we started in 2019. We started with 10 intel analysts in Columbus and Cleveland. I kind of thought we would be on a bit of a marketing strategy for a while, because again, we were specialized in narcotics, but we didn't have any original jurisdiction. We weren't codified until last year, but no one had to use us. There was no requirement for anyone in the state to use the Ohio Narcotics Intelligence Center. But I was just blessed with being able to hire some amazing analysts. I mean, I was able to hire geospatial engineering analysts, homeland security, infrastructure, master's degree people, just this team of crazy experienced people with tremendous experience. I've got former FBI analysts. I've got English majors. I've got people with intelligence degrees. This team of people that just came together and absolutely knocked it out of the park. So the next budget cycle, they doubled our budget and said brick and mortar in Cincinnati and Toledo. So we did that. And now I think we're still doing a little bit of hiring, but when these last couple of analysts come on board, we will have a total of 45 criminal intelligence analysts on staff, and then managers or support people in place to support them. But yeah, 40, we went from 3 or 4 to 45 and yeah. So
5 years. Like, wow. That is amazing. So it sounds like you had the support, but I am curious, because I think any time you get a new unit and maybe a lot of money is thrown your way, they're certainly stepping on somebody's toes, right? You're probably bound to run into a different jurisdiction or agency there in Ohio that felt threatened, for lack of better term. So I'm kind of just curious, how did that all come to be, as like how you were able to find your space, find your place, and then obviously working with all different varieties of, what did you say, like 900 jurisdictions or whatever it is there in Ohio? Like, so where was the pushback?
I mean, really, you hit the nail on the head, right? There are 900 agencies and or more. I mean, I think it's close to 1,000. So there's plenty of work for everyone. BCI has an amazing unit, but they're doing everything from that environmental dumping to unidentified decedents. And they've got folks that focus in the drug world, but out of the 17 or 20 that they have, it's a couple, and they do great work. They do amazing work. There's just not enough of them. And I think that's what we found out, was that even though BCI had narcotics analysts out in the field, and the patrol, the Ohio State Highway Patrol does, they have analysts that focus on it. There just wasn't enough of them. And the need was such that it was kind of funny when we first opened doors, we could tell that agencies were kind of testing us, right? Mm-hmm. They would bring us like one phone or two phones and these little sort of onesie twosies things. And we had to prove ourselves. I mean, we had to prove ourselves on the forensic side and the analytical side, but we did that and we built up their trust. And then COVID hit. And of course, we were still in the middle of hiring people. I remember one poor lady, we met her in the office to give her her laptop and said, "Here's your stuff. Go home. Somebody will call you tomorrow." Right. Like, I mean, it was, everyone was doing that, right? It was a learning moment for all of us. But it seemed like once I think agencies kind of fell into their sort of COVID pace, if you will, it felt like they went into their evidence rooms and brought every digital device out of their evidence rooms to our doors. No longer are they bringing us onesie twosies. They were bringing 10, 12 phones at a time. Our forensic unit last week said that they had intake numbers over 70 in just 1 week. With our powerful tools and our amazing forensic specialists, we're just knocking them out of the park. We have almost no turnaround time. There's maybe a week, maybe, which is kind of unheard of in the forensic world. And we do that on purpose. We intake those phones and get those reader reports back out to the requesters just as fast as we possibly can to help keep their movement going on their side. And then on the intel side, we sort of have this, I don't know, we call it like the a la carte menu, right? So you can bring your phone in and have the extraction and handle the extraction yourself from there, or you can have it passed over to the intelligence side of the house. And then they will produce what we call court ready products that are literally ready to go to court from that. Or if you just need analytical assistance in helping identify some cryptocurrency tracing or some Spanish translations, or we have a financial team if you need some financial investigative assistance. So you can kind of have the whole five course meal, or you can pick sort of a la carte, which I think has also kept us, that flexibility has been the key for us. There's really kind of no rigidity to it. Like you can, as a customer, you can come in and request everything or just this bit, right? And I think that has really kind of helped us. And then we stay in our lane. I mean, we're drug-related crime. We're drug-related violent crime. So if somebody comes to us with something that is outside of our scope, we have absolutely zero hesitation to say, you should call the Highway Patrol analyst, or this falls more in line with something that BCI would have expertise in. So why don't you call them first? And so we train with them. All of our intelligence units across the state, when we are fortunate enough to have classes come in for our analysts, if we've got open seats, we'll call our colleagues in other departments and say, hey, we've got an open seat. Why don't you try and send somebody? And so that all ships rise with the tide kind of thing, right? We're all working in the same for the same thing, right? Justice and closure for families and things like that. So it's, I don't know, it's been an amazing experience. It's far greater than I ever dreamed of 5 years ago, for sure. But I think we've really found our niche and that partnership with our sister agencies, and it's been really, really good.
Yeah. And I was just going to ask you, as you're talking about it, because how do you focus on anything if you have so many services right there? But you finished it up at the end where you do have a certain criteria where if it doesn't quite fit, you suggest other services in Ohio. So that makes sense. Certainly the growth, it speaks for itself, and it sounds like for the most part that you got the buy-in, and just the number of customers leads to the success. I'm curious to know, was there anything else how you measured success, even if it was just you personally?
We measure our success not just on turnaround times and cases supported and that kind of thing, but the fact that we have repeat customers. They come back time and time again. I don't know, one of my favorite moments here was we're physically situated in Franklin County. And when we first opened our doors, there was an individual who said, "We don't really prosecute those kinds of cases in Franklin County. You might want to start selling your services somewhere else." And nothing makes me work harder than a no. And in this case, it was a very polite no. It was a no thank you. But so when our first case came up, it was just undeniably well put together. No way they could say no. And they didn't. And when that prosecutor's office got a hold of our first product, the response was, holy cow, this is a game changer. And so to get that kind of feedback, to sell a service and a product in a place where they said no thank you, and now they come back and they come back and they come back. So, you know, I think that is very telling. And then we've got some amazing partnerships. We've got analysts embedded with the crime gun intelligence centers. We've got analysts embedded in the strike force. We've got analysts embedded in DEA task forces. In fact, one of our analysts last month was featured. He was involved in the cryptocurrency seizure, the largest cryptocurrency seizure in DEA history, $150 million. He was one of the analysts that was doing the crypto tracing. And so I think having those kinds of stories and having those repeat customers and knowing that we turned that one particular customer in from a no thank you to I can't get enough has been really amazing. And big picture, the overdose rates are coming down. One of the other fun things that we did here was when we have some, we call them like networking teams, where we have these regular cadences with the Recovery Ohio team, which has law enforcement and health and mental health and addiction and recovery resources. It's a very collaborative group of folks who are tackling the overdose epidemic from all angles. So we have a monthly cadence with them where we are very transparent about statistics, the drug seizures and what the labs are saying and anomalies that the labs are seeing, trends that we're seeing across the nation and across the world. So being able to have like an epidemiologist from a small rural county in Ohio, that person having the ability to log on and listen to firsthand data every month is, I can't even imagine how powerful it must be for those folks at the local level. It allows them to take, instead of a fire hose approach, they can be real precise now with their resources. They know how the landscape is changing over the last 30 days and what law enforcement is seizing. And then to have that information in their toolbox as they're dealing with recovery and addiction services and those kinds of things. It's a remarkable group and I'm so proud to be a part of it. We also have one of those networking circles with the crime labs that do the testing, the toxicology testing across the state. And so they are reporting to us anomalies and trends in the crime labs, and that allows us to have a much bigger picture and to talk back to law enforcement resources and our recovery people and get a holistic picture of what is going on in the drug landscape in the state of Ohio. And that has allowed us to be extremely proactive in scheduling emerging drugs in the state of Ohio. I think we've now scheduled 11 emerging drugs in the state of Ohio, a couple faster than the DEA, which is, it's not a race, but that's kind of fun to say. But I mean, that gives law enforcement that tool to enforce that law that much faster. And it gives the recovery and health folks that information as quickly as they can so that they can, you know, pay attention to their QRT teams or their hotspots or saturate an area with Narcan and resources and information. It allows them to be really proactive at the local level. So I'm extremely proud of sort of the out of the box thinking that we've got here. It's also allowed us to communicate with the public our laboratories were the ones that realized that the seized pills that were marked M30s were not M30s, that they were actually everything in the kitchen sink, right? Including this dangerous fentanyl and so deadly fentanyl. And so we packaged a public bulletin on the pills, the fraudulent, the counterfeit prescription pills, and that they could be deadly, and carry that message of don't take anything that's not prescribed to you and given to you by a licensed pharmacist. And we published it in, I think, seven or eight languages to reach as many Ohioans as we can. And so now when we see those changes in the landscape, we do that. And we've done, I don't know, I think probably 8 or 9 public facing bulletins in multiple languages so that we can inform the public just as quickly as we can about the dangers in the illicit and the changes in the illicit drug market.
Nice. All right. Well, we got one more story here. So we got Corey's story.
Oh, Corey's story.
2020.
Yeah, Corey. So Corey was the victim of a drug poisoning, an overdose case. Her body was found in sort of a warehouse area here in central Ohio. And when we train on these cases, we think of it as like reverse engineering, right? We've got this decedent. How did she get here? Who is she? How did she get here? How did this happen? And so it's I feel this tremendous responsibility to speak on her behalf, right? To collect every bit of information that we can, every data bit, every record that we can, to tell her story, because she's no longer here to help us tell the story. So it's our responsibility, and we take that extremely seriously. In her particular case, we had really good call detail records from her and the dealer and the supplier. We had some Google location data. We had precision location data from the supplier. We had a lot of data. In fact, this is a 3-ring binder kind of case of just tons and tons of data. And Corey did an amazing job for us. She could not have known how powerful her last selfie was going to be. She took her last selfie at the most perfect moment. It put her in her dealer's car. It put her in a location that we could corroborate was a meeting point. She had a receipt in her pocket that helped corroborate data. I mean, we had tons and tons of information, but we train on her case for two reasons. Number one, to emphasize the importance of all of those data bits and how to do what we call the craft of storytelling through digital evidence analysis. How when we call it Corey's story, when we train on it, it's using all of those data bits and the layering and the mapping and her selfies and the receipts and everything to tell her story. And it's a good ending. Both the dealer and the supplier were both convicted, and our primary analyst, our lead analyst on that, was recognized at the local level for his work on the data. The data was just amazing, and how he was able to put it all together. And then the way that he used, it's just PowerPoint, right? But the way he used PowerPoint to tell her story over like a, I think it was about a 2-day period, to tell a lot of her of the what happened to her, exactly what happened to her over that time frame using these detailed records. And so I love that we still talk about her. It keeps her memory alive, right? But it's also a really good training tool for our incoming analysts to see what we can do, the tools and the resources that can come together to help tell that story of an overdose victim, a drug poisoning death.
Yeah. And you mentioned yesterday when we were in the prep call, what is particularly sad about her case is that she had her life turned around up to that day.
Yeah, she was on the path to recovery. She had a good job. She was getting her family back together. She was on the right track. And the consequence of one bad decision led to her situation. But it is. It's a tremendous responsibility for us as analysts to dig into every single case, to tell that story, to speak for those victims that aren't here to help us represent them, to make sure that we can find justice for people like Corey who were doing so well and one bad day, right? One bad day was it for Corey. But we will continue to talk about Corey and keep her memory alive here and teach other analysts the value of not only being able to decipher and use the data to tell the story, but why it's so important that we do that.
Very good. Before we move on, what's next for ONIC?
We are currently hiring and are expanding our areas of not only criminal intelligence analysts, but we have developed a team of drug-related violent crime analysts that will focus on some of those larger cases. Like we had a case in a jurisdiction that had, I think it was 72 violent crimes over like a couple of years window. And they have crime analysts who are good at what they do, but they needed an intel analyst to just take all of the, I don't know, it was probably thousands of reports and intelligence and information together, and then to synthesize that into, again, those timelines and link charts and the NIBIN data and collecting all of those bits from across the resources. And in the end, they were able to take out of those 72 violent crimes, I believe 68 of them were directly connected to rival gangs in that city. And so those are the kind of cases that our drug-related violent crime analysts will focus on, is sort of those bigger picture, longer term cases that the local jurisdictions might need help with, just kind of taking that 10,000 foot view of all of these crimes. And by being able to identify it down to these two rivaling gangs, it allows the local resources to be kind of like, instead of having that fire hose approach to violence in their city, it allows them to use that precision laser, saying, sitting the team, those gangs down and saying, please stop the violence. They've had a child now, victim from the gunfire in that case. Please, it allows them to go back and be more precise with their resources and to try and get those gangs to stop the violence. So it's exciting already to be able to see those 72 crimes boil down to those two rivaling gangs. We're expanding our Spanish translation team. We are expanding our financial team. We have hired trainers to do not only internal training, but external training as well. How do we take some of these programs that we've developed here internally and share them with our intelligence partners out in the field? And so we're doing that too. So it's a really exciting time to be in the ONIC. The cyber cryptocurrency area is growing. It's really, really taken off here. The encrypted communications and then the cryptocurrency for in drug trafficking is not the future, it's the now. And so to bring trainings in and resources in to get everyone tooled up and resourced up on those so that we can continue to have the impact that we're having in those cases, it's going to be fun.
Oh, man. I have so many follow-up questions, but we'll be here 3 hours if I don't stop. So I am going to move on. I want to finish up the interview talking, getting your perspective on hiring analysts. And it's something that we've been talking about on the show recently. And from your perspective, I want to split it into two different sections. The first part I want to talk about is the idea of team building, maybe more of a from your supervisor and director point of view, because you certainly have built two fantastic teams over your career, as we just heard. And then the second part, I want to get your advice for the analysts themselves as they go through the hiring process. But I first want to talk about building the team, and you must have an eye for talent because you're certainly hiring the right people over and over and over again.
I think it's obviously experience and skills and abilities, blah, 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 right? But it's also finding that right character that can bring their skills to life in the team, right? So it's one thing to hire a cybersecurity specialist. It's another thing to have a cybersecurity specialist that can teach my analysts what they need to know in their cases to help bring out, you know, those points in their investigations. It's one thing to have a geospatial engineering master's degree analyst on the team, but it's another thing to hire one who is excited about sharing her skills with her teammates. And so I think it's, and I hate to say that we hire on personality, but I mean, those KSAs have to be there, right? You have to have the KSAs, but I think interviews are extremely important for getting to know the person and the personality. Are they going to be that hoarder and actually of information and keep it all to themselves? Or do they have that personality where they want to share their experiences? They want to share their skills with others. And we have been extremely blessed to have some amazing folks. And they're not all of them are in the management team at this point. All of them have come to the team with a great interest in using their abilities to foster, take these cases to the next level, but also to foster growth in others. And I think that has been a real big difference here. And I think that attitude kind of starts from the top, right? I mean, it starts with me just being a goofball and being upfront with people about goofy mistakes I've made, or that camera in my face and that deer in the headlights moment. Being candid with them about allows that sort of safe place. We call it psychological safety, and we actually train on psychological safety too. But it's okay to be vulnerable and to share a funny story, because if it helps the team grow, it's for the better of the team. But also, we do things like, over the last month, we've all been doing CPR certifications, not because we are out in the field all day every day, but because it's a great team building exercise that we can do that enriches their lives and might help, you know, help them down the road someday later. But those kind of team building things are also important. I think we do tons of training and creating those safe spaces, but also having those moments where we do team building that is maybe not directly connected to just intelligence analysis, but enriches our lives in other ways.
So in terms of your process, though, of trying to identify the right candidate, because you've gotten to the point now where I'm sure you get a lot of applications and you have to whittle it down and you have the interviews process. Do you have particular questions, or go through your process there of what you look for when you're in the interview?
Yeah. So, I mean, we've got like 45 analysts on staff. We've done, at this point, probably hundreds of interviews. I like those questions in the interview process where we say, tell us about a time when you missed a deadline. Mm-hmm. Tell us about your favorite boss. Tell us about a boss you didn't care for. Tell us about a time when you had a problem with a coworker, and how did you handle it? I think those kinds of questions are very telling about what their mindset is going to be like. Anyone who says, I've never made a mistake, I've never missed a deadline. Well, also, we also have a question that is, what do you need to improve upon in the next year? Mm-hmm. Or what would you like to improve upon in the next year? And of course, those people, there are ones that say, nothing. I've got my degree and I'm ready to roll. And it's like, well, okay. Like, there's got to be, make it up. Say you want to read more. I don't care. Just don't come to the table with nothing. But I like those sort of open-ended questions where they get to tell us about how they reacted to a negative situation or a problem that they had, or are they going to be open with us about a time when they made a mistake or missed a deadline? Is it believable? Is it, are they truthful? How did they handle it? Would they have done anything differently? I think those are some of my favorite questions. Those, I can see on your resume what your degree is and pretty much what your experience is. But I think those kind of questions really help us understand how you're going to fit into the team and how you're going to be open to learning and how you're going to take feedback, because we have a very pretty intensive peer review process here. And it takes a pretty strong person to take something that you're proud of, hand it to your neighbor, and then let them write it and come back to you and not get your feelings involved, right?
Yeah.
So I think having those open-ended questions and hearing their answers to that really helps us kind of understand how they're going to deal with our business processes, because peer review and getting redlined, I laugh when I turn my stuff over to my coworkers for peer review, because I know I'm going to have some dangling participle. I don't know. I'd have to go look it up again, but apparently I'm known for that, whatever that is. I still don't know. But yeah. It takes a certain amount of self-control to be able to do that and to get that red line back and know that you're going to have mistakes and it's not personal. They're trying to make you product better and you better. But because we all do it, even I do it, I think it sets the pace. And I can laugh about it too. And I'm like, look what my colleague did to my paper today. Then it kind of takes that fear out of it, right? Of, oh, look, she's the director and she's still getting redlined on things. So I think it helps. I would say nothing's more annoying to me than people who come into an intelligence unit for an intelligence job and they can't define intelligence. Tell me what intelligence is. The thing you can say to me, I will instantly shut off and I don't have a game face. You're going to know what I'm thinking immediately is, it's just information. Oh God. Okay. For the love of God, please Google the agency and the section and the position for which you are applying. And we have polygraphs and background checks. So they really dig in on those polygraphs. I don't know if you've had one of those before or not, but yeah.
Yeah. not a fun time for me. I don't, not something that I ever want to do ever again.
Right? Kind of thing. Right. Right.
Yeah. So, all right. So you mixed in there with advice to the analyst, but one of the things that I hear a lot from folks that are hiring is the analyst, they could have the KSAs that you're looking for. They get nervous. And maybe they're introverted, maybe they're shy or whatever it is, a little socially awkward. It's hard for them to get in that space, like in that 15, 30 minute interview to sell themselves, right? Mm-hmm. Once they're there and they get comfortable with the situation, they could be one of your best analysts. But because of that scenario that I talked about, okay, you've made it this far. Now you got 30 minutes to impress you. Do you have any advice for those people that are just maybe in that description?
We've all been in that seat. You know, we've all been that person. We've all been in that position. So I think, you know, to understand that everyone at the table is human. And honestly, I've got some folks who don't like interviewing. They're not comfortable interviewing people. It's just not something that they're comfortable doing. And so there's kind of discomfort around the table, I think, is what I would say. Is we have the pressure of trying to fill a position, but we've also got all the other pressures of the day. So I think my advice there would be that everyone at the table has some of those emotions going all at the same time. So if you understand that, I mean, there have been times when I've pressed pause in an interview and go get somebody a drink of water. Just here, let me go get you a drink. Let's start over. So I try to be as disarming as possible if I can, if it's appropriate. There are times when I'm done after the second question. And my boss is like, I could tell after question number two, you were done with this person. And I'm like, they're hiding something. They're not being forthcoming. They think they're perfect. There's no way this person is going to be a good fit in my team. They don't know what intelligence is. When one of the questions, tell us what interests you in this position. And they're like, well, I hope you could tell me more about that today. Don't be that analyst, right? So I think if everyone understands that there are all kinds of emotions at that table, then maybe yours won't be so intimidating.
All right. Very good. All right. Let's finish up with personal interest then. And you have a cattle farm.
I do. We have about 30 head of Black Angus cattle.
So is this what's the goal of this?
Delicious food in my freezer.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure I didn't want to assume that and like, oh, these are all my pets. What are you talking about? Right.
No, my husband, it was a childhood dream of his to have a farm, and mine as well. We both grew up in 4-H and and our kids grew up in 4-H and FFA, and we've had the whole menagerie of animals on the farm. And even though the kids have grown and are doing their thing now, we still have the herd of cattle, and it keeps us really busy. Something very rewarding about the work. It's hard work, and I'm out there on tractors and rakes and all kinds of things too, right beside him, hauling bales into the barn. And it's a teamwork kind of thing with my husband and I, but it's extremely rewarding work. It's no one bothers you, first of all, when you're out on the mower. it's a nice place to just clear your head and complete your tasks, and extremely rewarding to be able to bring nourishing food from the hayfield back into the barn and to see the animals grow and then the new babies. We had, I think, 17 babies this spring or this fall on the farm. So a whole bunch of little ones running around and jumping and playing and growing. And so it's just a very rewarding hobby. And then also to know the food that we are putting on our plates and in our bodies. We know basically every bite they have taken. We understand every medicine that they were given or every treatment they were provided. It's knowing that I'm putting a high quality, healthy product into my body. And my father-in-law has 1,000-square-foot garden at my house. So there are plenty of vegetables to go along with it. My husband announced to me the other day that I have not eaten enough green peppers. I apparently put enough green peppers in the freezer for an army. And
of a quota.
Yeah, I've not gotten through them the way I normally go through them, but I need to learn now that the kids have moved out of the house. I've got to learn to prepare and store things a little differently, acclimate to the two of us. But it was fun too when my kids were little. You know, I'd come home and they would have gone to the garden and picked fresh vegetables, and so they grew up with all of the animals and the fresh vegetables. And And so that healthy eating, understanding where your food comes from and how important it is to have high quality ingredients. Don't get me wrong, we eat our share of junk on the run occasionally, but yeah, it's extremely rewarding and fun and a good hobby for the two of us to work on together.
Yeah, I can't believe it's a hobby. That's a full-time job.
Some days.
Yeah. And so, well, your kids are future farmers of America. So for those, you said FFA, and I recognize that. But in case our listeners don't know what FFA is, that's Future Farmers of America.
Yeah, it's kind of fun to call into my boss every now and then when I'm sorry, sir, I'm going to be late today. There's a cow loose. I got to go wrangle a cow. And I have accidentally come into work one time with cow poo on my shoe.
Oh,
and
man. Oh, man.
It keeps things interesting for my boss. He's he is not surprised by much of anything these days.
Oh, man. Well, very good. Hey, thank you so much. I as I said, I could go on and on talking to you, but I am going to finish up with words to the world. And this is where I give the guests the last word. You can promote any idea that you wish. Cindy, what are your words to the world?
I believe the sign of a good leader is that when you leave, they will miss you, but they won't need you. So if you're taking care of the little things and empowering people to reach their fullest potential, you are a good leader.
Very good. Well, I leave every guest with, you've given me just enough to talk bad about you later. But I do appreciate you being on the show, Cindy. Thank you so much. And you be safe.
I appreciate your time, sir. Thank you very much.
Thank you for making it to the end of another episode of Analyst Talk with Jason Elder. You can show your support by sharing this and other episodes found on our website at www.leapodcasts.com. If you have a topic you would like us to cover or have a suggestion for our next guest, please send us an email at leapodcasts@gmail.com. Till next time, analysts, keep talking.